Seeing Values in the Parables, Section 2, The Parable of the Two Builders, Matthew 7, 24-27, Luke 6, 47-49. Many of Jesus' most dramatic lessons were taught by means of comparing two people who had much in common, but who reacted to challenge in a very different way and hence experienced very different fates. That is the teaching for us in his parable of the two builders, which is in Matthew's Sermon on the Mount and Luke's Sermon on the Plain. The two accounts differ in language and detail, but the story is the same. It is a story of two men who faced similar experiences of adversity. One of them came through the experience with victory. The other saw his life go down in ruinous defeat. The two results corresponded exactly to their two actions when they faced a common decision. Read the text of both accounts. Now note the setting of the story. In both accounts, the parable came at the end of Jesus' sermon on the kind of life which men should live. In both accounts, he had rebuked people for claiming to be his followers, even while they did not live by the standards he set up for his followers. Luke's account has the very searching question, verse 46, "Why do you call me Lord, and do not what I tell you?" Then Jesus compared his hearers to two men who faced the decision of where and how to build a house. The first man chose a ledge of rock. The word translated rock meant a ledge of rock, such as one sees beside a stream where the water has cut away the soft soil and left only the rocky ledge standing. Luke's account, verse 48, states that the man dug down and went deep into the rock, preparing a foundation on which to build his house. Hard work. The second man took the easy way. Beside that rock ledge, there was a level plot of sandy ground. It was easy going to dig into the soft sand and set the foundation on which to build a house. Jesus called a man who chose the rock ledge and dug deep into it for a foundation a wise man. The word in Matthew 24 meant an intelligent man. Very exactly, one who acted with wisdom and forethought. He considered the long-range possibility of the storms which might come, and he acted to meet that need. On the other hand, Jesus called a man who built on the soft, level sand a foolish man. This word meant imprudent, one who acts without wisdom or forethought. This man did not consider the possibility of future storms. He considered only the ease of the moment. The wise foresight of the one man and the foolish short-sightedness of the other became apparent when the season for storms and rains came. From about May to October, in that land there were no rains. During that time, both houses fared well. Then the rainy season came. What the foolish man had chosen as a nice, level, soft place to build turned out to be the dry bed of a stream, a wadi, it is called over there today, and the wise man's location was the nearby ledge of rock beside the dry wadi. Matthew's account emphasizes how thoroughly the houses were tested by the storms, verses 25 and 27. He states precisely that the rains came down on top of the two houses. The torrents of flash flood water came up underneath the two houses. The winds beat against the sides of the two houses. They were both tested exactly in the same way, and they were thoroughly tested, top, side, and bottom. The house on the rock, with its foundation secure in the rock, stood. The winds could not shake it. The rains and torrents could not undermine it. But when the dry wadi was changed to a raging flood, the house which had been built on the sand fell before the combined forces of the winds and the undermining torrents. It is a very natural story. But what did it mean to Jesus' hearers and to us? He applied it to two types of people. Both of them are looking for a foundation on which to build a life. Both of them hear Jesus' words, pointing out the good life of obedience to his lordship. Both of them understand that such a life involves the hard way of rejecting evil and all that is foreign to that lordship. One of them decides that it is worth the cost. He chooses to build his life on Jesus' principles. The other decides that it is not worth the cost. He rejects Jesus' principles and builds his life on the easy foundation of self-will. For a while, it may be difficult to tell that one has any better way than the other. But when the testing storms come, as inevitably they do come, to beat upon those lives, top, side, and bottom, it is the one who built his life on Jesus' words who stands, and the one who rejected that foundation who falls. Two men live in the same town. They live on the same street. They work in the same business. They move in the same social circles. They attend the same church. One day, disaster comes to both of them. Business reversal, physical loss of health, family tragedy, personal sorrow. One of them stands firm through it all. One of them comes crashing down in ruin. What made the difference? The foundation on which they built in the days before tragedy struck. It is a very 20th century sort of parable, this parable of the two builders, and it has a sermon within itself. Next, the parable of the two sons, Matthew 21, 28 to 32. Everyone who knows anything about the teaching of Jesus knows the beautiful story of the man and his two sons in Luke 15, 11 to 32. It is usually called the parable of the prodigal son. But how many people know the parable of the two sons in Matthew's Gospel, chapter 21, verses 28 to 32? It is shorter, more abrupt, less beautiful, but no less soul-searching than the better-known parable of the two sons in Luke. Read the text of the parable in Matthew very carefully. Now study the setting of the parable. It was Tuesday before Jesus' death on Friday. On the preceding Sunday, he had made his triumphal entry into Jerusalem. He had used an acted parable to offer himself as the son of David King by riding a donkey into Jerusalem, as Solomon had done when he came to be inaugurated as the son of David King, 1 Kings 1, 32-37. And as Isaiah 62:11 and Zechariah 9:9 had said that the Messianic King would come to Jerusalem. The people had given him a tumultuous welcome, and their religious leaders had been horrified by it. They looked upon Jesus as a lawbreaker, not as the Messiah. Then on Monday, Jesus had broken up the sacrificial system and financial support of the temple by driving out the animals which were being sold for sacrifice and sold at such high prices that it amounted to robbery. Matthew 21:13. He turned over the money tables where the temple tax was being collected at an exorbitant rate of exchange. In the eyes of the religious leaders, that amounted to Jesus taking over the operation of the temple, and that was the work of the priests. So early on Tuesday morning, they asked him by what kind of authority he had acted. By priestly authority? He was not a priest. By kingly authority? Did he mean that he was the messianic king? Jesus responded by asking them about their views of the authority of John the Baptist, who had announced Jesus' coming. Was John's authority from God or from men? They refused to answer because either way they answered, they would be hurting themselves. If they answered, John's authority was not from God, it was from men, they would hurt their cause with the people who believed that John was from God. On the other hand, if they answered, John's authority was from God, Jesus would ask, then why did you reject him? So they refused to answer. Jesus countered by saying, then I will not answer your question on authority, but I will tell you a story. His story was the parable of the two sons. The father of the two sons requested one of them to go into the vineyard and work. The son answered, I will not. That answer has a rather modern sound. Later, however, he changed his mind and went into the vineyard and worked. The father requested the other son to go into the vineyard and work. He responded readily, I go, sir. But he never did keep his promise. And that, too, sounds rather modern. Having told the story, Jesus asked for what we would call today some audience participation. He asked the religious leaders, which of these two boys actually did what the father wanted? Was it the one who was at first disobedient, but changed and obeyed? Or was it the one who professed obedience, but gave no evidence of obedience? Their answer was the only possible one. The one who did what the father wanted was the one who at first disobeyed, but changed to obedience. The one who professed obedience but never acted upon that profession was never really obedient to the Father's will. Then Jesus applied the story to the situation. God was the Father in the parable. Those who were at first disobedient but repented and became obedient to the will of God were the lowest of sinners in the Jewish mind, tax collectors and prostitutes. Those who professed to do the will of God, but actually did not, were the religious leaders. The key to obedience or disobedience was response to Jesus. The sinners were responding to him in repentance, faith, and obedience, and were entering God's kingdom, coming under God's rule. The priests and elders were rejecting Jesus and missing God's kingdom, staying outside of his rule. In Jesus' view, both classes of people were sinners, disobedient to God. But one group of sinners recognized their need for forgiveness, and committing themselves in faith to Jesus, were experiencing forgiveness. The other group of sinners had no consciousness of need for forgiveness. They felt sufficient within themselves. They were missing the blessings of God's lordship. Every person who reads this soul-searching parable must decide which class he belongs to and what decision he will make before God. Time and eternity are involved in that decision. Next, the parable of the lost sheep. Matthew 18, 1-14. Luke 15, 1-7. In the parables previously studied in this unit, we have focused on parables in which Jesus taught by contrasting two people in different response to a common situation. In this one, let us study two different applications of one parable to two different situations. This, too, is a well-known and much-loved parable. Apparently, it was much loved by the early Christians. It is recorded in four of the Gospels of the first two centuries. The Gospel of Luke and the Gospel of Matthew in the New Testament, and the recently discovered Gospel according to Thomas and Gospel of Truth, which were second century Gospels that did not find a place in the approved list of books which became our New Testament. In each of the four, it was applied to a different situation. In this study, we will look at its application only in Luke and Matthew. I'll let you read my book, The Secret Sayings of the Living Jesus, to see how it is used in the Gospel according to Thomas and the Gospel of Truth. First, study the parable in Luke's account. The setting in Luke was one of controversy between Jesus and the Pharisees. Jesus was in Perea, traveling to Jerusalem, where he would die during Passover week. In the large company making the pilgrimage from Galilee to Jerusalem were not only his friends, but many of the scribes and Pharisees who were watching Jesus' every action to observe any point at which, in their views, he did not obey the religious laws. On this occasion, they complained because Jesus welcomed the company of sinners and even had table fellowship with them. In the opinion of the Pharisees, such conduct was sinful. In response to their complaint, Jesus told three parables: the lost sheep, the lost coin, the lost son, each of which stressed the central concern of God over every lost person. He told of a shepherd who out of 100 sheep had one that was lost. He told of a woman who out of 10 coins had one that was lost. He told of a father who out of 2 sons had one that was lost. He stressed the joy of the owners over the finding of one sheep out of 100, one coin out of 10, one son out of 2. Now the shepherd, the woman, and the father were not unmindful of the 99 sheep, the 9 coins, the one son at home. The focus of their attention was, however, on the one lost one, and their rejoicing was over the lost one that was found. That concern is clear in the parable of the lost sheep. A shepherd putting his 100 sheep through the single entry opening of the place of shelter and protection out in the hills detected that one was missing. No indication is made in Luke as to how it became lost. The simple stress is on the fact that it was lost. In such brief, illustrative teaching, there is legitimate room for great latitude in reasoning as to how sheep are people become lost. In Matthew's account, 18:12, the sheep was lost because it just strayed away into the wilderness. The shepherd closed the door upon the 99. He went out into the hills where the sheep had grazed that day. He searched long and carefully until he found the lost sheep. The Gospel of Truth says that he wore himself out working to find the sheep, even though it was on the Sabbath. When he returned to his flock He called upon his neighbor shepherds to rejoice with him in his recovery of the lost sheep. Verse 7 contains Jesus' application of the story to the situation in which self-righteous religionists complained about his association with sinners. The joy in heaven in the lost sheep parable, verse 7, and the joy in the presence of angels in the lost coin parable, verse 10, both refer to God's rejoicing over lost men who are found, even sinners and social outcasts. The thrust of the parable is that Jesus associated with sinners because he represented a God who loved sinners, every individual one of the sinners. He loves them and rejoices in their being rescued from their lostness and disobedience. He has more joy over one repenting sinner than he has over 99 religionists who have no consciousness of sin and need of God. So the parable of the lost sheep in Luke illustrates God's concern over every needy individual, no matter how lost he is, nor how he became lost. How is the same parable used in Matthew? Read again the total passage in Matthew 18, 1-14. The setting was in Galilee before Jesus and his companions started to Jerusalem for Passover week. It was not a setting of controversy between Jesus and the Pharisees, as in Luke. It was one of controversy between the disciples of Jesus as to which one of them would be greatest in the kingdom they expected him to set up. It was soon after Peter, James, and John had witnessed the transfiguration of Jesus, Matthew 17:1-8, and Jesus had subsequently rebuked the other nine for their lack of faith in not being able to heal an epileptic boy, Matthew 17:14-20. That led to an argument over relative greatness. One can almost hear the privileged three, Peter, James, and John, insisting that if they had been present, they could have healed the boy. So Mark 9:33 says they argued the question of greatness in the kingdom from there to Capernaum. It was also in the same period of Jesus' ministry that the 12 tried to prevent mothers from bringing their little children to Jesus for his blessing, chapter 19. They wanted to get the kids out of the way so they could get on with the business of the kingdom. Jesus took one of the little children into his arms on this occasion. He used the simple, non-self-seeking nature of the child to show that kingdom people are of that character, not seeking and shoving for a preferred position, the sort of adult grasping of which the 12 were guilty. Then Jesus told a parable of the lost sheep. He told it in a way which challenged his hearers to make a judgment in a situation and to give the obvious response. He said, "How does it seem to you? If a man had 100 sheep and one of them strayed away, would he not leave the 99 and go to seek the straying one?" The obvious answer to that is, of course he would. Then Jesus applied the story to the little children. As it was not the desire of the shepherd that even one straying sheep should come to ruin, so it was not the desire of the Father in heaven that even one of the little children should come to ruin. Verse 14. In Matthew, the thrust of the parable was at the point of pastoral concern and leadership within the worshiping community. Jesus was concerned about the little children because God was concerned about them. God is concerned about the one who in the eyes of men is the least and most insignificant one in the worshiping community. God's spiritual leaders, the 12 in that setting, any religious leaders in our setting, are to be concerned for the welfare of the least one in the worshiping community. There is to be no attitude of getting them out of the way in order to get on with the business of the kingdom. They are the business of the kingdom. Now in review, look again at the two applications of this one parable to two different situations. In Luke, the application was to a situation which we may speak of as evangelism. God's love for every individual person, no matter how sinful and how lost he may be. And the responsibility of God's shepherds to seek every lost individual to bring him to God. In Matthew, the application was to a situation which we speak of as pastoral concern. God's love for the least one in the worshiping community. The responsibility of God's shepherds to seek and secure the welfare of every individual in that group. In reality, it was a rebuke to the 12 because of their failure to see the significance of the little children in the group. In this day of unscriptural attempt to isolate evangelism and social concern as two opposite and unrelated spheres, we do well to study these two New Testament applications of Jesus' beautiful parable and to observe that both evangelism and social welfare are God's concern. Jesus' own ministry is our best evidence for that. The religion that does not look out, reach out, lift out, and help out is washed out. Such is not the religion of Jesus. Such is not the religion of the New Testament.